Thank you. thought I was doing something more attractive than that. Wow. Well, you can't take, you know, I can't take it too serious. I met a guy named Sam Chapman. He was one of the several players that were uncovered by Alan Lomax years ago. But unlike Muddy Waters, for example, no one ever noticed Sam Chapman, even though he'd been discovered, rediscovered, and gone out and toured. Nobody knew it. And I ran into him, and I think it was in Missouri. He was sitting out in front of his motel room. We were sharing the same motel, and he had a little plastic chair that I also had. I had one in my room. He moved his out to the cement, and he was sitting there with this enormous sort of ZZ Top beard on him, and he was about 83 or so at the time. He was drinking a glass of Kool-Aid, and in the other hand, he had a peanut butter and jelly sandwich that was just rotting in the sun. It was just bursting the seams. But he was delighted. I said, "Are you Sam Chapman?" He said, "Yes." And I talked to him for a while, and he claimed to have lived on Kool-Aid and peanut butter and jelly for the last 20 years of his life. And I decided then that there was less to this business than I thought there was. I ought to stop worrying. So I did. And a matter of fact, the next time I was really down in the dumps, and I don't know what it was about, but it basically was the result of taking it too seriously. I was looking forward to Kansas City because I was going in to play this place that I had played before. It was a theater a little bigger than this, real nice place. And I loved it, and I'd been in some real holes, and I was looking forward to it. And I got there, and somebody had vomited down at the front of the stage the night before. And it was a clue to the way this place was being managed that nobody bothered with it. It was still there when I got there, you know, 12 hours later. Only now it had, you know, decorated the entire room with its memories and French fries and so forth. I didn't like it, neither did anyone else, but nobody wanted to go near it. The river had risen and the sewers had backed up, and they were like, this is an old theater at any rate. The backstage was worse than before the stage. So I was sitting there really now starting to whine and complain, and I said, who's the support? And they said, it went away, and I asked someone else. No one wanted to confront the answer to this question, and I finally learned that it was a guy that had gotten out of a nursing home. He was 90 years old. He was not Sam Chapman. When I met him, he was an astonishing guy. He was 7 feet tall, which means, you know, when he was a young man, he was 8 feet tall. So he adjusted this. He had on a suit that Jerry Lewis had given him. It was powder blue leisure suit, that style that was so popular for a while in the nursing homes. He had white shoes and a white belt and a little tiny white hat. Didn't fit his, just sat up there, you know, like bunk. And I looked at him and I thought, oh, you know, this is the wrong business for me. And he went out and he was so bad that the audience adored him. He was a ukulele player. He had a ukulele about this big. Not a standard little puny ukulele, but a super puny ukulele. And a 7 foot, 90-year-old really wheezing away. And it took me forever to get the crowd back in it. You notice there's no support act here today. After his set, I said, "Are you really? Did they really get you out of a nursing home?" You know, I wanted to just knock him down, but He said, yeah, and I said, well, why do you do this? And he looked at me like I was an idiot. And he said, this is what I do. So when I forget a phrase like that,
thank you.
I recently had the musical time of my life doing a tour with Pepe Romero, Paco Pena, and Joe Pass. And we had met initially in Australia about 4 years ago, where we'd done some shows together. And when Columbia Artists asked Joe what he'd like to do back here in the States, he said, "Why don't we do one of these tours that we did in Australia?" And it was indescribably hilarious and a lot of fun. I was in danger most of the time because both Pepe and Joe Pepe is, Joe was a cigar smoker, and I thought I had to do that as well if I wanted to stay on the bus, and perhaps it was the source of their skill, you know. If it was that easy, I didn't want to miss out on it. So I tried a few times, and I remember one night it started out sort of mystically, because we were driving past Niagara Falls. It was the middle of the night, and we stopped the bus. We all stumbled out, Susan the agent, and the four of us, and the bus driver, wandered over to the falls in this fog and lit up some cigars. And they got back to the bus a long time before I did. I made use of the falls. On that tour, Joe dissected a cigar for me one day to show me how it worked. I've been asking him these questions. Well, you know, if you zip, and there aren't a lot of moving parts in a cigar. Joe's really into it. I would ask, you know, he spent 12 years playing with Oscar Peterson, which is unimaginable to me, and he said, "Yes, it was really hard. If I was having a good night, Oscar would just make it worse. I'd modulate into some rat's nest of stuff." But I could never tell, neither could anyone else. And night after night, Joe would go, he'd never touch his guitar all day long, because he didn't want anything to happen until he was out on stage. And he'd go out cold as a fish and just play his ass off every night. And so I was continually trying to pick his brain and learn some harmony and so on and so forth. And I stopped that after a while, because if I wanted to know if this was right, he'd say, "No, what are you doing?" And he'd grab this finger and put it up here. Oh. That's smart. Anyhow, before the tour and after Australia, I woke up one morning at the Beverly Garland Howard Johnson's. And that's a horrible experience in itself. I was trying to go back to sleep, naturally, and I looked over on the thing you hit your head on, and there was Joe's cigars. It was the last cigar of his that I had. I can't imagine why I hadn't smoked it. This was some Cuban stuff that he'd gotten in Australia, so I thought, "Oh, what the hell?" And I reached over and lit this thing, and wrote this next song in a fit of inspiration and nausea. Sun belt and the telephones and the telephones and the telephones. You look out the moon where the window is every day and morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. Some of us breathe in the brown ground where the worms clown, where the worms clown, where the worms clown. Way down below in the sun belt every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. Night when you lay down, you fall flat, you fall flat, you fall flat. And some of us breathe in the brown ground every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. So we're all asleep in the same dream, in the snort fort, in the snort fort, in the snort fort. Every night when you lay down, and every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. Somewhere, but I didn't know, but it really means everything to me. And I found out a few weeks ago that it's the theme from a Frankenstein movie. Theme from the Rick and Bob Report. says, baby, what you doing? I've been wondering where you've been. Now and then I think about you and me. No use fighting about things we can't recall, 'cause it don't matter now at all. Just come on in, baby, we'll laugh and sing and we'll make love. Let the telephone ring. Ring, ring, doorbell ring. Come on in, I got Mel Blanc on the radio. I'm glad you came around. I've been feeling down, talking to Tony and Mario. And you know they make good conversation. Still it ain't no consolation, 'cause I got love. Baby, I'll give you something. If somebody comes, let the door know me. Supposed to be just a damning insult, but I ran out and got all of Verdi's greatest hits. It reminded me that I've always felt that some pieces, especially some of those instrumental things that happened in the 50s and the 60s, were really designed for the guitar, and maybe they did sound a little absurd in some cases, but that was because it wasn't being done on a guitar, and you know, the container was bigger than its contents is what happened, I think. And that was really appalling to some people who've never been able to forgive these tunes for what had happened to them at the hands of somebody else. So I've taken it upon myself to resurrect some of them at the peril of my career. And I've learned that there really is no danger in doing this, that I'm right, that they sound great on a guitar. The first record I ever bought, though, was Dee Dee Dinah by Frankie Avalon. So I do have to be careful. I can't exercise a little judgment. I've learned from this tune that my audience is made up mainly of dope dealers and chiropractors. I have what might be called a wide, very wide, but shallow demographic. I mean, all kinds of people have really positive memories around this tune. And most people go, what is that? It's like, and I never tell them what it is. The guy who arranged this piece invented the click bass, which we can only forgive him for. And also the lonely trumpet, which was later picked up on by Herb Alpert. And I don't play any Herb Alpert tunes. And this one piece here, the biggest hit that Bird ever had, he replaced his usual trumpeter, who was, I think, Austrian. At any rate, the guy he got was a Bavarian, actually. Are those exclusive of one another? Where is Bavaria? It's Germany, isn't it? It's not. Yeah, okay. Chicago is in Idaho, I know that. Thank you. also written by somebody else. I would tell you who it was if I could remember. The last one was arranged by Bert Kempfert. This one was written by an unknown guy in Nashville, and but I pay him. She lives all alone on a dark and windy street, in a room at the top of the stairs. Smokes a cigarette and stares at the wall, knowing that my heart lives there. In the cool of the night, she takes me inside and helps soothe my troubles and pain. Warm and sweet, her kisses leave me weak. I love it when she touches my face. She talks about the past, the sorrow and regret, cries about the gray in her hair. I love her so much, but she just won't believe any man alive could ever care. Wish I'd been there when she was a girl before, but I treated her unfair. Not be so sad, she'd not live alone in that room at the top of the stairs. That room at the top of the stairs. It had something to do with the lead weights that I used to boil in Cheyenne. You get the tire weights, you boil them in a coffee can with your head directly over the fumes, so you can watch it all get shiny and, you know. And we had these little billy clubs drilled out in the center. You'd pour the lead into the club so it could really pack a wallop, and then you put the club away and, you know, go back to your stamp collection. So this is, I'm going to take, they're comfortable with a break here, the management, so I'm going to take a short break after this so you can mop the bar. It's a 20-minute break. At the stroke of 20, I'm going to come back out here. I would like to play a tune that was written by Pete Seeger called Living in the Country, which is one of the really nifty guitar pieces that I've written. And I've also had dreams about these breaks. I come back and you don't, so
I guess I owe it all to
all of my good times, all my running around. One of these days I might be in your town. And I guess I owe it all to Pamela Brown.
Thank you.
I think from somebody's poem. It's a study of manic depression and its coincidence in the artistic temperament. It's written by the head of the psychiatry school at Johns Hopkins, and she tries to make the point, or insists on making the point, and fails in her introduction, that she doesn't want to reduce artistic inspiration to just a bunch of symptoms. And then goes on to more or less prove pretty, it proved that everybody you ever heard of who was any good was a manic depressant. What makes you, I mean, there's some really, there's some amazing stuff in there. She's working on the human genome, for example, and is pretty convinced that sooner or later we're going to find a gene for manic depression. And really the whole argument in the book is, if there is one, is that manic depression is very valuable. And if we can eliminate it, we should not. This is coming from a psychiatrist, you know. She convinces you real easily. She draws up a list. This is mainly about writers, this book. And she draws up a list of poets over the last 300 years because they're, you have no doubt, if you ever wondered before, that of all of the artists that there are, poets are the craziest. She shows you this list, and she has a system of little, you know, ampersands and asterisks and those little swords and those other things. Whatever those are called. And each one denotes, suicide attempt, successful suicide, depression in the family, institutionalization, bizarre behavior. The poets, it looks like a Christmas tree by the time. And you'll notice in this column of lunacy, you'll notice a couple that have nothing beside their names, and they're poets that you've never heard of. So she points out that a lot of people who are manic depressive wouldn't want to be any other way. And she says one of the reasons for that is you create when you're manic and you edit when you're depressed. That kind of makes sense. I think I've experienced that myself. She did a study of British writers, and 90% of the poets she studied were Protestant. Whatever that means. That's odd. And 50% of them, the novelists, were Catholic. I figured out reading this book was that if you're a poet, it really won't help you to go nuts. Well, your poetry won't improve, but if you're nuts, sooner or later you're going to write a poem. I have a friend. Well, he's the guy who wrote the Rick and Bob Report. I mean, I wrote the tune. He wrote the series. That's how it was when I first wrote it. This guy, Bob is Bob Comfort. He's written several movies since then, Dogfight. He's working on one. At any rate, he's still working despite the Rick and Bob Report, which ran once a week at 3 a.m. on Monday mornings. And he moved to Ashland, Oregon. I went up there to see him. I was playing there and said hello and found out that the water supply in Ashland, Oregon contains a naturally occurring load of lithium. So there are no poets in Ashland, Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Something that I think everybody ought to know. I thought of it all by myself, and I'm very proud of that. The Rick and Bob Report, which originally began as a sort of a fantasy, was expected to extend into a real study, an examination of people from the lower end of the bell curve. And Bob had some people already lined up. One of them was a guy in Japan who had been living for years next door to a neighbor who had a dog, and the dog was one of those loud little trumpet-like animals that just won't shut up. And the neighbor wouldn't do anything, and he couldn't figure out what to do about this. So the guy's solution was to jump into the yard one day on all fours and meet the dog, man to man. He lost an eye. It's kind of torn up. But he was victorious. And I thought of that when I got a dog like that, a little dachshund. And it had a bark that would just split you in two. It wasn't a bark, it was just a pierce of some kind. Here's what I found out. You can tune your dog. Take him to the veterinary and tell him, "Tune my animal." Actually, I wanted the vet to just silence my animal. "It doesn't have to bark. Just remove the bark." He said, "No, that's no. I kind of thought he'd say that. But he said, "I can tune it for you. the larynx. And the dog goes from yim 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 to whoa whoa whoa. It's like heaven. So if you live next door to a dog like that, I guess the solution is to steal it, take it to the vet, pretend it's yours. Go ahead, you can just jump in the yard with it. Also, dogs are, I shouldn't tell you that, whatever. Dogs are, yeah, dogs can't eat chocolate. My dog's stomach has been pumped now 3 different times. Somebody said, you know, I said, ha ha, the dog ate, you know, like a pound of something. It's kind of staggering around. And guess what it deserved? And then they told me, you know, that the dog will die. Take it to the... It was moaning. I'm alone a lot of the time. That's not... Well, this is a ballad I'm trying.